I'm Dr. David Malbranche, Senior Director of Global HIV Medical Affairs at Gilead Sciences.
I am Dr. Christopher Chauncey Watson, Global Marketing Director at Gilead Sciences.
Welcome to Zero Hour, a podcast brought to you by Gilead Sciences, where we will be speaking with leading health and culture experts to understand the barriers that keep global populations from meaningful, transformative care. We'll shed light on inequities, we'll celebrate innovation, and together, we'll imagine a world with zero barriers, zero disparities, zero new infections, and zero people left behind. It's possible, but there's zero time to wait.
Backlash, feuds, viral trends, and shameless shaming. In the age of social media, our feeds are dominated by what's hot, what's not, and competition to be the most visible and the most adored. At the center of it all, influencers. Those with the power and platforms to make a statement and hear it echoed by millions around the globe. But what if the things we tweeted, posted, and shared had the power to do more than just entertain or provoke? What if they had the power to end an epidemic? I am Christopher Chauncey Watson, and with me is my co-host David Malbranche.
42 years ago, the HIV epidemic changed the world. Now, it's time to change it again. I focus much of my work as a healthcare practitioner on addressing the disparities that hold us back from ending the HIV epidemic.
Thanks, David. Our conversation today is going to focus on the power of influence in today's social media climate. Social media is mostly known for online beefs, public shaming, self-promotion, but it can also be a tool to make some change, create community, as well as lend voice to the voiceless. Today, we're going to be talking to two powerhouse individuals who use their social media and celebrity status to bring change and awareness for those living with HIV. Greg Mathis Jr. is a televised personality and activist who is breaking down walls in Hollywood, one stigma at a time. Our second guest today is Bevy Smith, an international speaker, award-winning TV and radio host, author of best-selling memoir Bevelations, and her TED Talk was the third highest watch of 2022, with over 3.6 million views. Let's start with you, Greg. Greg, what brings you to this conversation?
I mean, well, my uncle actually passed away due to complications from HIV and cancer. And, you know, the blessing is that he lived 20 years healthy because of the advancements in medicine. But through watching his life, our entire family, we saw him struggle. He struggled to access quality community care. He lived under the shame and stigma of his diagnosis, afraid to tell people because, I mean, the criminalization that exists for people living with HIV. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that really motivated me to want to speak out and do what we can to end this epidemic once and for all, because we are so close. Mm. And I'll say, from a personal perspective, as a gay black man, that's who this epidemic is disproportionately impacting. And the fact that I have an ability to use my voice to help change that, I mean, there's not much I'd rather be doing, to be honest.
When you start to think about your uncle and what he'd went through, how did that impact your family? What was the effect that it had?
It was tough to see him struggle with his health for such a long period of time. But even more disturbing was the treatment that we knew that he'd receive if anyone were to discover his diagnosis, mm-hmm. or people that maybe knew things. You know, it wasn't when people normally get sick, mm-hmm. there's sympathy, there's mm-hmm. Love. And for whatever reason, when it comes to HIV, that doesn't always seem to be the case. It seems to be followed with shame and stigma. And that was the toughest part, watching him have to live with that.
How did that impact you and how you handled your own sexual identity? How you navigated inviting people into your space, determining who was worthy, who wasn't worthy to be knowledgeable of this, and navigating all those minefields that you could see, that you saw your uncle go through? How did that affect you and mm-hmm. your own personal journey?
You know, I've said this before and I'll say it again. I don't know if I'd be here if it wasn't for the example set by my uncle. He was the first gay black man that I saw that was living courageously and openly and not ashamed of who he was. Despite the discrimination that he faced, he never kind of backed down. My Uncle Steve had a crazy mouth on him. He had attitude like no other. He'd cuss you out.
With his journey and with your journey, a lot of people talk about coming out as if it's one singular experience. Like you're in the closet and then all of a sudden you're out. What was your journey like? Was it as binary as that? Or was it more of a progression of maturity and evolution?
The second. So my family first, I'll say, discovered my sexuality when I was a freshman in college. My brother kind of heard some things about people at school and, you know, called me. I denied it. Then I finally told him the truth and he went and told my family. And they loved me from day one. That was, you know, I'm very blessed to have that because I know that that's not the reality for a lot of my friends who are in this community as well. And so that journey for me started when I was about 18 years old with my family. I had a fear of disclosing it beyond my family just because with that shame in our community, my dad was already a judge at that point and I didn't want to, you know, damage his career, you know, because my uncle was gay. So anytime he'd talk about gay rights or anything like that, he would get attacked by his fans. And so it took me another 15 years up until I was 30 to come out more broadly to the world. And even with that, it's still a journey. Every day it's working through how to be the most authentic version of myself, which I think is so important to live in your purpose.
Yeah. Do you think now you serve as a role model for others?
So I'm always hesitant to use the term role model because I feel like all of us are unique and deserve that right to live unique lives. I don't want anybody looking at me and saying, this is exactly how I need to be. But what I will say is that I do live with the thought of to whom much is given, much is expected. None of this would be possible without God. And so my focus has always been to live in my purpose and hopefully show other people that they can do that as well.
We've talked about the issue with role models and you being a role model just by being authentically who you are, unapologetically who you are. And the relationship with your father, who has been known for generations as Judge Mathis. Millions of people have watched him on TV, and we've seen this relationship play out between the two of you all on your show with regards to your sexual orientation. I went through a similar thing with my father, but it wasn't quite as easy and accepting. And my father was an old school Caribbean immigrant from Haiti, and he didn't quite have the acceptance that your father had with you. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that journey and about the importance of having the example of a black father and son that have this kind of affirming relationship and how your father's acceptance of you was important in your life?
My father and our, you know, my relationship with him is a true gift from God. And I know that a lot of gay children do not have that experience. You know, you talked a lot about me being unapologetically myself. That was a journey. That wasn't always the case. It took 30 years for me to get to that point. You know, living through the shame, living through the stigma and the fear of being who I was. And I can say, and this is where, you know, the gift from God comes in, that in the back of my mind, I always knew that my father, that my family was going to accept me no matter what, because I knew what he stood for. Yeah. He's always been a champion for people who are marginalized, whether it's black people, whether it's gay people, whether it's, you know, people who are of a lower socioeconomic status. That's him. That's him in and out. And so I never had that fear that he wasn't going to accept me. What it was for me is the fear of society. I was worried about going public with my sexuality, knowing that even before he was on television, my dad was a prominent political figure in Detroit. He was well known. He was on the church circuit. You can't go in churches preaching with a gay son out publicly. You know that.
Kojic.
That was Kojic. You know, that was always what prohibited me from being who I really was.
So you were trying to protect your dad.
Absolutely. 100%. You know, inviting the world into who I am and disclosing my sexual orientation. You go to his Instagram page, whenever he talks about this issue, he gets attacked. There are those comments. And, you know, he is so courageous in the way that he tunes them out. And what he says is, look, if you are using religion to not love your child, you need to reread your Bible, because Jesus never said a word about homosexuality.
Yeah.
He only preached about love for your fellow human being. And if it's not religious, then you're just being selfish and hateful, you mm-hmm. know, because there's no reason to deny your child the right to be who they are because of your own personal hangups and your opinion on how they should live their life.
You mentioned how important it is for your father and that acceptance that you had in the home. How did that influence the confidence you had to invite people from general society in?
Well, when I finally got that confidence, it was like, it's no turning back. I was like, look, I got my family. You know, thank God I got my friends. I don't care what anybody thinks. Yeah. Like, I go out into the world every single day showing up as myself with the confidence that comes with that. And I look back on the person I was before I was able to do that. And it's night and day. It's night and day. There's no need to shrink myself. There's no need to dim my light. And I am really the best version of myself that I've ever been because I was finally able to jump over that hurdle that had been on my back for such a long time. Yeah. And every single person deserves that right. Every single person deserves to go out and live with that level of liberation because otherwise, what the heck is life about?
We've talked a little bit about the journey of coming out or inviting in. Can you tell us specifically how that played out on Mathis Family Matters for you?
We had a conversation on the show, having a barbecue in the backyard of our house. I had this conversation where I said, you know, Dad, I'm thinking about being more public in my sexuality. I've always been afraid to because how it would impact your career potentially. And he says, what do you mean? Like your colleagues and friends in D.C. don't know you're gay? And when I said no, he burst out into tears because I think it hit him in that moment that I was living this life as two different people. He knew instantly it clicked for him the weight that carries in any human being to have to shrink yourself, to have to hide who you are and not be the most authentic version of yourself. So it hit him hard and quite frankly, it made him angry. He said some stuff off camera that I was like, Dad, you can't go out talking like that in the world because you know my dad will, you know, he has his, you know, he can be very strong in the way he delivers his statements, but it hit him hard and it put on his heartstrings in many different ways. And I think that's why he has become so much more vocal and active in this work to really try and show parents that you can love your child. Beyond that, you know, my dad went a step further and said, son, I'm going to give you a challenge. This is the fight of your lifetime. This is the fight of your lifetime. And I'm going to give you a challenge to not only live your life in a public way, but to continue to pave a path so that others can as well. You know, you're my son and you have this platform that God has given us. Use it in a way that benefits other people.
Let's bring in Bevy Smith to this conversation, a.k.a. Mother. Mother, you serve as a beacon of hope for so many people, same gender loving, women, just anyone who understands that it truly gets greater later. Why are you in this conversation? Why is this important for you?
Well, thank you, first of all, for using my most valued honorific mother. Yes. That means the world to me. And Chauncey, you know this. Two of my female cousins perished in the AIDS crisis of the 80s. Mm-hmm. And I had to watch that happen. And so that's how I really got kind of activated. Mm-hmm. And knowing that women, black women, while our numbers have gotten much better, our numbers are still too high. As a woman who a lot of women connect with, identify with, and look up to, honestly, I have this voice. I have these multiple platforms, and I'm going to use my powers for good and not just for self-promotion. Fashion for Action was just a very organic and natural thing for me to be a part of.
I wanted to ask you, use the phrase same gender loving. For people that don't understand what same gender loving is, I always like to give credit where credit is due. Cleo Monago, who's been an activist, Dr. Cleo Monago, came up with that term a while ago because the word gay for a lot of black same gender loving folks was ostracized because of the associations the word gay had with femininity, Cher, white people, everything else. And a lot of black men who are attracted to other black men would say, well, that's not me. Mm-hmm. So when someone would ask them, are you gay? They'd say no.
Yeah.
But then go home and have intimate relations with another man.
Yeah.
Dr. Monago came up with the word, the phrase, same gender loving. Mm-hmm. And I remember him telling me a story that when he used that phrase, someone came up to him after he gave a presentation. And she said, thank you for saying that. I didn't know loving was a part of it, which was phenomenal to me. And that just goes to show you the power of one word can actually take away from the intimacy, the love that same gender interactions have with each other. And it just, it struck me with that. So I want, as I heard you say that, it was so affirming. So
Oh, you know what? And I'm so glad that you laid it out in that way. There's so much academic language that goes on now that isolates folks from even seeking help.
Yeah. To your point, language matters.
Yes,
right?
It does.
And exactly in this conversation where we have to learn in that keeping out. I've heard so many people around the world just say, well, you're marketing to this group, right? You're saying gay or you're saying lesbian or you're saying black. I'm not those things. I don't identify.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so for me, same gender loving, and to your point, and to Dr. Cleo's point, it brings the love into the conversation. So that's why I like to use that phrase.
That's beautiful. I just learned so much.
Right?
It's a good thing.
That's what happens when you hang out with the doctors.
Right?
The doctors.
We have
and
a
such.
Conversation.
Right. Yes, yes.
Bevy, you know. I wanted to ask you, in your opinion, how can the fashion industry really do a lot of work around HIV advocacy?
Well, I think the fashion industry has always done a lot of work around HIV advocacy because, as you know, our industry was decimated. And I worked in the West Village, and I went to NYU, which is also in the West Village. And between classes, I would have to go and visit people at St. Vincent's. There would be people lined in the hallways. There would be people dying horrible deaths in those rooms because people had ostracized them, family had stepped away from them, and it was so powerful. What I do remember about the fashion community is that they did step up. You know, they did raise a lot of money, they raised a lot of awareness, primarily because it was literally a disease that they were on the front lines of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Fashion for Action, I guess we've been doing that now for almost 20 years, maybe.
To your point earlier, we've come so far. Yet, we have so far to go when we're speaking about ending an epidemic. I want to bring us to this impact of stigma conversation. It is stigma for people living with HIV. The labels that we use provide stigma to those who may benefit from prevention efforts. Mm-hmm. And so when we're speaking about this global perspective, we often find ourselves in this divisive pieces. But it's the stigma that combines us. So let's maybe move to this conversation of how do you, in your platforms of as influencers, how do we use these public platforms? So if I have a mic, how do I use that mic to combat stigma?
Well, we all have a mic at this point, right? Social media has given us all a mic.
Okay.
So we all have a platform. And I think it's really important that we realize that. We realize our power and we step into it.
Mm.
So as you guys know, for me, I have a radio show, Sirius XM, and I always try to make sure every single year there is some kind of HIV AIDS programming on my show. I've had numerous guests talk about it because, you know, sadly enough, many people believe like it's over.
Mm-hmm.
That, oh, you don't have to worry about that anymore. And it's so crazy because a guy I was talking to romantically was like, oh yeah, I don't have risky sex. I'm like, well, if you're having sex,
there's always some risk.
There's a risk.
There's always some risk. And I think you're so right when you talk about, I always say, use your voice. Mm. We all have a voice, especially with social media now. We're not just sitting around the kitchen table. We're in a community-wide conversation. And so when I think about my platform and my voice, it's having those conversations, whether it's online. I still have them behind closed doors as well.
Mm.
But I've been posting publicly about this epidemic, about how we can protect ourselves, educate people, because that's a big part of it. It's really educating people. When people understand the level of risk, and you know, like you said, there's always a risk associated with it. When people understand that level of risk and have the resources and education to make informed decisions, that's how we make the progress. And I think that's how we end a lot of the stigma that we deal with, by really giving people the tools to understand what's actually happening.
How do you use your social platform now? Because advocacy is different. It was very dire.
Yes.
It was very severe back then. It's a different context now. Can you speak on what it was like for you then doing the advocacy work
Greg's generation has so many other options. And there are so many life-saving, medications out there. And it's no longer a death sentence. Back then, if you told someone, I'm HIV positive, automatically folks were like, well, we better start planning the funeral. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So there was such a stigma. People were incredibly thin. I remember when Magic Johnson came out about having HIV, and people were like, oh, it's a wrap. And now look, what is it? 30, 40 years later, he's still here.
Right.
So you would think that folks seeing Magic Johnson live with HIV would have been a boon, would have maybe perhaps removed the stigma, but instead it was, oh, he's only living because he's got the money to live. Yeah. Not knowing that the medicines that he takes are now available to everyone.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that's exactly right. And I focus on my platform, putting the facts out there, because the facts are indisputable when you look at prevention, testing, and treatment, that we got a whole different ball game now. We have a ball game where I know we said we might be a long way off from ending this epidemic.
Yeah.
I don't really think so when you look at what we can do in America.
Yeah.
If we put those resources and those educational tools out there for people to look at it, and it makes me feel really good. I'm not going to lie now. I put a picture of me kissing my boyfriend up. It gets, thousands and thousands of likes, or a video of us on vacation, you know, it goes viral. I put up some of these educational resources. It doesn't necessarily get the same engagement, unfortunately.
For me, it is that moment, because we don't have this, right? So I remember an interview some years ago, the interviewer said to me, well, do we need to go back to the scare tactics? And I was offended by that. Mm-hmm. I was offended because of, one, the work people have done to get us here and to get us to this moment in the innovation. But because we don't have people dying anymore, because the science has advanced so much, why don't we get the same likes for education?
Look, it's Bevy's a marketer, but look, sex sells, People right. like to see what's sexy. They like to see the trash can on fire. Yeah. And unfortunately, we're at a point in this epidemic where the trash can maybe isn't quite on fire. It is difficult to get people to pay attention when maybe there isn't the same level of urgency and we're at that last leg of the race.
Let's get some trash cans in here.
Right. No, but this podcast is important for that reason.
Exactly.
Because we are having this kind of conversation, this nuanced conversation, but it's not dire.
Yeah.
And it is hopeful. People need to know that we can have a conversation about HIV and AIDS without it being scary, without using scare tactics, and without having just a sense of dread and a somber tone connected to it. No, you can live. But first of all, let's talk about that prevention. Let's do the work so we can prevent new infections, right? Yeah. Many communities of color, folks know about PrEP.
So when you say HIV PrEP, you're saying HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis. So you're taking a medication when you're HIV negative to prevent you from getting HIV.
But I think to these points, let's be clear, no healthcare system has been developed proactively, right?
I mean, I can tell you in my case, I've been with my boyfriend for 7 years. Mm. Full disclosure, I'm no longer on PrEP after, several years of us being together in a monogamous relationship. But prior to that, for the first 3-4 years at least, even with us being in a, I'm using air quotes for those who can't see me, monogamous relationship, I knew I wanted to be on PrEP to protect myself as much as possible, even being in a monogamous relationship. And I think those are the important conversations that we have to have, is that there is always risk when you're having sex.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think sometimes the conversation, Chauncey talked earlier about language matters. It always does. And most people don't see themselves when you're having sex that is natural to you and the person you're having it with as risky.
Yeah.
Sex does not automatically equate to risk. And so a lot of times when people will say that between two men or two women or a same gender loving relationship, it's given a different context than when it's with a heterosexual couple who may not use condoms and may be monogamous. That's not seen as risky.
Black women are getting HIV at some of the highest rates in the American population. And so there is definitely risk in those heterosexual sexual encounters.
Monogamy is always a very tricky thing, because what's monogamy to one is not to the other. Everyone's
hey, look, we're still having fun with each other. And that's what we said. And, you know, if it gets to a point where we need to have a little bit more fun, then that can be a conversation, too. You know, everybody has what works for them.
Yeah. But I also like that you were honest with saying that you're not on PrEP any longer, because I think that that is something that I know with my friends who are same gender loving, that does come up. Sometimes they just go off. And I even, and Chauncey knows this, I spoke to a doctor about it. And she was like, well, you know, if you're going to have a hot girl summer, maybe you do want to go on PrEP. And, you know, and then maybe like when you're not having that summer anymore, then you can come off of it and everything. It's great to have those conversations overall. And I wish we were having more of them. I wish more Black women were having more of those kind of conversations. It enrages me that when I go to a doctor, an HIV test is not automatically offered.
Crazy.
It enrages me.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. Is it ageism? Do I not look juicy, like I'm ready for a good time?
Unfortunately, my personal opinion is that this epidemic is impacting marginalized communities. As we've seen through history, when something's impacting a marginalized community, there just isn't as much, people don't pay as much attention. You know, it falls by the wayside, it's swept under the rug, and we don't put resources into it. And I see that happening in so many ways when it comes to HIV.
I'm going to a private doctor. I'm going to, like, I'm a woman of some means. So, and I think that that does go to the racial disparity in the medical community, right? That no matter how much money you have, no matter what your level of education is, there's still going to be these racial disparities that happen. I now that I have a Black gynecologist, a Black female gynecologist, I have wonderful news to tell you guys about my vagina, by the way.
Let's tell the world.
Yes,
let's hear.
She told me I have a pink cervix, smooth walls, and incredible lubrication.
So, doctor, tell us, medical doctor.
Yes.
What that mean?
Well, it just means that she's healthy.
Ow.
Yeah, I'm healthy.
Come through. Healthy.
Yeah. Healthy, it's amazing, sexy for me. Which is why they should be asking me to take an HIV test. Like, because I have it going on.
To keep it healthy.
Keep it healthy. But of course, because she's a Black female gynecologist, she did ask me, would you like to take a test? I said, yes, let's do it. And to the women that are out there listening, I would say, please make that a part of your annual, physical. Like, make sure you're doing that test every single year.
Sometimes the medical providers won't ask you. So we have to empower people as well to be proactive, to say, hey, why aren't you ordering an HIV test? Mm-hmm. Do not assume that it's going to be part of the panel.
And that is so important, because I talk about, my friends, we talk about sex all the time. We talk about sex all the time. It's one of the top things we talk about. Mm-hmm. But
do you
talk
about
sexual hygiene or sexual health? Exactly. Yeah. Mm. People get quiet when you bring up those topics, and we have to change that.
All right.
People don't talk about STIs, STDs, none of it. And how many of your straight girlfriends actually even ask the question of their lovers? Like, I'm sure very few.
When you speak of risk, Bevy, what are you speaking? And how do we start to speak about it better, particularly for Black women?
We have to call a thing a thing.
Mm.
When I tell people the numbers of, like, you know, oh, Black women, we make up new infection cases far surpassing white women.
Mm.
That's like a wake-up call. That shakes people to their core. What do you think is risky sex? Because a lot of times they're like, well, I'm not having anal sex.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you don't even have to have anal sex contract HIV. You know, or I'm only sleeping, I've been sleeping with the same person for, okay, girl, well, how many other people is he sleeping with?
Okay.
You know, there's all these questions that could be asked as follow-ups. But we have to have these frank and honest conversations.
Yeah.
When I get in my car, I put my seatbelt on and I make sure everybody else does too.
Yeah.
Because I know that there's a risk that if I get into a car accident, it reduces that chance that I'm going to die or be significantly injured.
Mm-hmm.
And so why don't we have those same conversations around sex? We're all having sex.
So risk for one person may mean anal sex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Risk for another person may mean oral or vaginal sex.
Yeah.
But the word risk carries a lot of stigma with it for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Because when I'm just having my life, I'm just connecting with someone. And let's be clear, when people have condomless sex, when they choose to engage in sex with someone without a condom, that's an indicator of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a connectedness that you're showing that person, I trust you and I want to connect with you. People don't talk about that human part of not using a condom versus using a condom as much as we should, but that's a huge part of this whole equation. And so when I'm doing that, I'm not having sex with you without a condom and seeing it as risky.
Yeah.
I'm seeing it as I'm trying to connect with you.
I think this is why a podcast like this is so important.
Thank you.
And having diverse panelists as well is important, because there's going to be some 50-year-old black woman somewhere in the world that's going to hear me talking about this and think, that's not for them. I'm not having risky sex. Why do I need to get an HIV test?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I've been with my boyfriend, my husband for blah, blah, blah. No, still go get it, girl.
Yeah.
I'm here to tell you.
For yourself.
For yourself.
For yourself. Own my health.
Yes.
Right? Own and be empowered here.
Yeah. Have agency.
And one last thing, because I know we got to wrap up. Bevy, you and I are both in entertainment. And you probably know as much as I, more recently learning this, is that as spontaneous as entertainment can sometimes appear, most of what we see coming out of Hollywood is very intentional in the stories that are being told.
Scripted.
And so we have a very, you know, this is a story that I believe needs to be told.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know how we do it. I don't know what that looks like, but there needs to be a conversation in Hollywood about telling this important story, mm-hmm. because that's how you change public opinion and that's how you educate people.
Shout out to our friend Nathan Hale Williams of 90 yeah. Days.
Yes.
I know he's coming on your show.
Yes. Yes.
You know, so yeah, we do have these storylines are in film and in TV, and we just need more of it, right?
Yep.
It's and we need folks behind the cameras that know how to tell the story in
Absolutely.
A nuanced way.
Yeah. What does ending the HIV epidemic look like for you?
So how we get there, we need resources for our community organizations that are doing the work on the front lines, and that's the testing, that's the treatment, and that's the education. Mm. We have to get that funding out there because it's life-saving, and we really could get rid of this epidemic in the United States once and for all with those 3 points, you know, that testing, treatment, and prevention.
Nice. Thank you.
And to piggyback onto that, I would also say education. I mean, we're in a fight right now about what children are being taught in school. You know, sex education is being, you know, eradicated, chipped away at every single day. But there needs to be conversations in homes. There needs to be conversations in church, because that is the way, for me, I think that we can eradicate this. Because imagine if a little girl is empowered. Imagine if a little queer boy is empowered and knows the risk and understands it from very early on.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's how we would eradicate it. But exactly. We have to be able to have these frank, yep. honest, open conversations. We need more dads in the world like your dad. You know, yep. we need just more folks that are not necessarily a part of the community that's most at risk to actually take that these kind of conversations on and use their platforms to amplify it.
Yeah.
I want to thank our guests today, Bevy Smith and Greg Mathis Jr., for taking the time to talk with us. It's given us all something to think about, how we can use our voices and platforms for good by being willing to tackle conversations that may not be comfortable, but that need to be had.
Mm.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Zero Hour. We've learned so much today about the past and the present of HIV, and there's even more to learn if we're going to change the future. Listen on for more global perspectives, more lived experiences, and more expert voices. I'm David Malbranche, and we'll see you at the finish line.
Subscribe to Zero Hour wherever you get your podcasts, and look for it on YouTube. And for more information, please visit GileadHIVTogether.com. This presentation is protected by U.S. and international copyright laws and owned by Gilead Sciences. The podcast should not be copied, reproduced, or distributed in whole or in part without express permission from Gilead Sciences. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gilead Sciences.